Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. We are your host, Aaron and Matthew Miller. Boy, do we have a topic to cover tonight. Back in 2004, the Keystone University, Ireland, released a documentary video entitled Atlantis, Ireland. In this documentary, the video claims that a Neolithic tomb at Nagrange is in fact the famed temple of Atlantis. And when you start looking at this for biblical connections, take note that inside the documentary it states that Atlantis, Ireland was devastated by a huge tsunami triggered by a comet that hit Earth over 11,000 years ago. Is this the Chicxulub event? If so, how can we tie this together with Bible prophecy? In the documentary, this is also included. It also argues that the advanced technology is in keeping with the belief that Atlantis was one of the most advanced places in the world before its destruction. They get their proof for this that you can find Irish boats, fishing, agriculture, and metalwork that has inscription upon it pointing back to their legacy. But it's not done there. It also points to the fact that the Irish DNA has been found throughout the world, including, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, red-headed mummies as proof that Ireland was the most advanced civilization in its day. This begins to rattle your cage when you check out this technical data. So when you consult the biblical text as to what was going on, well, let me just say this. We know that David Rohl has brought to the world the simple fact that they found the Egyptian statue with flaming red hair that wears a coat of variegated colors. This is beyond contestation. We have the evidence. Joseph and his bloodline clearly had red hair. So when we try to come to grips with what the Bible is actually telling us about this Gog and Magog, as we talked about in our last broadcast, the American Anakim, and it would seem that the American Indians were fleeing from these giants. So we already put forth, Aaron, that per the Ten Commandments, they would have had to have been, after the fourth generation, re-injecting their seed into the bloodline to keep the bloodline replenished. What's your thoughts on this? What's your take on it? And what have you found concerning this, well, this red-headed bloodline and what it might have to do with the Irish?
So most specifically, the Irish Book of Invasions, and also the Irish Book of the Four Masters, they are very clear. They were very sure of themselves that the Celts descended from Magog, the son of Japheth. And so when we're talking about the land of Magog, it does not seem that this is talking about a place, but a people. And these were the Celts. The Celts were largely nomadic, and so there were Celts called the Britons who were living in Britain. There were the ones who lived in Scotland and Ireland. So their Celtic beliefs show up all over. But most specifically, what were these giants doing? Well, like I said before, I think there's a certain woman named Albina, who is common in the Albion story of Britain. They said that, actually read what it says. According to the poem, in the 3970th year of the creation of the world, so that's Anno Mundi, a king of Greece married his 30 daughters into royalty, but the haughty brides colluded to eliminate their husbands so that they might be subservient to no one. The youngest would not be party to the crime and divulged the plot, so that the princesses were confined to an unsteerable rudderless ship and set adrift, and after 3 days came into the inhabited land later known as England. The eldest daughter, Albina, was the first step ashore and to lay claim to the land, naming it after herself. At first, the women gathered acorns and fruits, but once they learned to hunt and obtain meat, it aroused their lecherous desires. So no other humans inhabited the land. They mated the evil spirits called incubi, or basically fallen angels of lust, and subsequently the sons they begot, engendering a race of giants. These giants were evidenced by large, huge bones which were unearthed. Brutus arrived in 260 years after Albina, in the 1136th year before the birth of Christ, yet by there were only 24 giants left due to inner strife. As Geoffrey of Monmouth's version, Brutus's band subsequently overtake the land, defeating Gog and Magog in the process. So Gog and Magog is treated as one of these giants who were, I mean, clearly this is describing a Genesis 6 type event.
Yes, it's clearly describing that. And who was to know? I mean, who was to know that this Alba is actually what the Scottish call their land?
Yeah.
That's what they actually call it.
Yeah, so I think this isn't talking about Britain. This isn't talking about Britain Albion. This is talking about the Scottish Alba, or Albany. And that was, I think, well, we've talked before about the centers, the capital of the second incursion was at the Valley of Sedim. That was destroyed. We found that there's a possibility that this type of thing was going on in Europe. And so this especially was going on with the Celts, and they go into great detail with these entities, which they called the Tuatha De Danann. And they were sometimes described as angelic or demonic entities. Sometimes they're described as kings or with supernatural powers, or both. So it says they go in the Book of Invasions, the Irish Book of Invasion, which I mentioned before. It's also called the Labor Gabala Aren. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but it says they came to Ireland in dark clouds and landed on the mountains of Conhacnay. I'm sorry. I probably am not pronouncing these Celtish words right, which is basically in Connacht, Ireland. And they said that they spread a darkness over the sun for 3 days and three nights. They immediately burnt the ships so that they would not sink. They would not think of retreating to them. And the smoke and the mist that came from the vessels filled the neighboring land and air. Therefore, it is conceived that they arrived in clouds of mist. The poem in the Labor Gabala Aren says of their arrival, it is God who suffered them. Though he restrained them, they landed with horror, with lofty deed in their might, cloud of mighty combat of specters upon a mountain of Cymaicne, or of Connacht. Without distinction to discerning Ireland without ships, a ruthless course, the truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth.
Let me say this. We talked about this in a previous broadcast again. The Bible clearly depicts that an angel got into the fire and ascended Jacob's ladder. You talked about that the simple fact why we keep having this, well, we have this from Dagon. He was a fish entity, correct? We also have the people keep having this mythology that these gods were coming up out of the sea and they were fishmen. You stated that this could be a type of a way they were shedding their energy.
Yeah, man, that would take a lot of cooling. I mean, if you really were to approach a pure angelic entity, if it had not had transformed itself into flesh, I imagine that you were in danger of radiation exposure.
Yeah. As in close proximity to a nuclear chain reaction.
But what if this is partially why the giants had all these mutations? Were they irradiating the women that they were with?
Well, that is probably for another topic. However, what this is describing is that these entities were putting off so much heat that they come up out of the ocean, and it stated plainly that they come up out of the mist. It was creating a fog. There was such a release of energy into that water. So here we go again with this same idea that the fallen came down in the water and would emerge from the water. This is the same thing we've talked about.
Yeah, and here it says, here they go to four cities of Ireland where they teach their skills in sciences, including architecture, arts, magic, including necromancy. And this lines in with what we were saying about the possibility that Ireland is Atlantis. This is explaining what happened before the flood. The angels coming down and
yes,
teaching humans the various arts of the heavens and wherever. And there, wherever the giants go, they have some advanced civilization. We know that Ireland has the, of course, Stonehenge.
Right.
And then the New World has its various structures, including the massive pyramids and, you know, in Mexico. And so these giants were clearly, they always brought with them their knowledge. These entities always brought knowledge with them. And this is mostly why you have gods of, you know, if you look into mythology and stuff, you have gods of writing and gods of science and, mm-hmm, you know, and of knowledge and things like that, because that's what they would freely give people, especially if you were to sacrifice to them. So these entities, they, as we mentioned, they had centers of where they were doing this, capitals of their sin. But we know, why would these angels have focused their plan on Sodom and Gomorrah? Because they knew what the people were like. They knew the people would rape whatever they got their hands on. So this was exactly what they wanted. So, of course, they would have focused their act there. So, I've mentioned before that the main leaders of the second incursion appear to be two specific entities. They bear various different names, but Dagon is one of them. He has various different names, but his name as Dagon appears among these Irish gods, the two Tuatha De Dedan, and his name is the Dagda, which we agree sounds a lot like Dagon. Like Dagon, he's a fertility, agriculture deity, and he also controls weather and crops. So this is basically, not only do we see this event, but we also see that he is engaging this sort of lifestyle. It says that Dagda is said to be the husband of the Morrigan and the lover of Boann. Okay, when it says that, he performs literally one of the greatest, you know, acts of adultery in all of mythology. It says that Dagda had an affair with Boann, the wife of Elkmar. In order to hide their affair, Dagda made the sun stand still for 9 months because their son, Angus, was conceived, gestated, and born in one day. He, along with Boann, helped Angus search for his love.
So, now we're going to talk about this Angus, aren't we?
Yeah, so here we see, of course, an angelic entity coming down and taking a wife. Almost comparable to the Bathsheba event.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this Boann is treated as a river goddess, which we can also see in Greek mythology. See, Greek mythology reflected a lot of these things that were going on in that time. But we're going to get to that. But this Angus figure, I came to believe, may actually be where we get the word Magog, Gog and Magog. Beginning to think that Angus is literally another name for Gog, and that his alternative name, Mac-Indoc, sounds a lot like Magog.
Well, it's really interesting in its final form. It really does remind you of Gog Magog, the
Mackinac.
Mackinac, yes, the Mackinac, I guess. You take a look at this, and especially how he is depicted. It is amazing how his hands are stretching into the heavens, and the birds are flocking around his hands. But Aaron, you get into this, and wow, this makes a whole lot of sense that this redhead giant. Look, everything is being depicted that this makes sense. This is Magog. It's off the hook that particular demon, and it's blended into just a single name, Gog Magog, is actually in their mythology.
Yep. And we have, whenever you hear of Gog and Magog, a lot of people think, oh, they're two places. But this is proved wrong in Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 2. Son of man, set your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and the prophecy against him. Okay, so Gog refers to not a place, but a person.
Right.
Magog, of course, refers to his people.
His people.
The Celts.
Which... you're calling Magog, and he explains himself. Magog is who? The people of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal.
Yeah, which we find out what is Magog means Celts, Rosh means Russia, so you're talking about the Slavs. Meshach, you have another group of Slavs. Tubal is also where the American Indians come from, or the Siberians. So, this is basically trying to rule over a bunch of Japhethites. So this figure may also appear again in Greek mythology. Y'all might be surprised. We have a genealogy of Perseus and Dionysus, and it's an insane genealogy. You can look it up on Wikipedia. Just type in Aegyptus, Aegyptus. Look that up and then scroll to the bottom. It'll have an intense genealogy. And in this genealogy, Zeus shows up into the bloodline four times.
Four times.
Every once in a while, when a daughter shows up, he'll come and, you know, have sex with her and they'll bear a child. And so there are two big lines. There's descended from him. There is Belus, who of course represents the tyrant, and then we have Eginor, which I'm starting to think is the same as this Angus.
Is this Gog? So you have Bel on one side and Gog on the other.
Yeah, and this supports my theory that they were that there were three sons of the survivor of Kush Shakar. He had Bel, who was the tyrant. He had Anak, who was so Bel had authority over the Shemites. Anak was given authority over the Hamites, and then this third one, Gog or Angor or Angus, he was given authority over the Japhethites, but he never engaged in the Titanomachy, as far as we can see. But he went up to the north and he was performing his own things in that area. And as we have evidence of, he was going all over the world.
Well, more importantly, getting back to this presupposition as to why the American Indians are called, what are they called? Yeah, nomads. Were they really trying to flee these giants? That's exactly what they tell us. I mean, you get into their mythology. They're the ones that bring up, yeah, by the way, we had to duke it out with red-haired giants, which is just off the hook. And it's not, you don't get the big structures, these big, well, especially lined up to the stars, until you get into Central America. They kept fleeing, and these giants obviously caught up with them in Central America. And of course, if you look at the geology of the matter, that's not only concentrated once again at the Chicxulub impact, but it also creates a bottleneck. You look at North America where they come across the frozen ice. The farther you get down, you just get bottlenecked there south of Mexico. You're into a serious bottleneck. That's exactly where they trapped them, in that bottleneck. That's where they got a hold of these people and subjugated them, these giants. So when we look at these things biblically, it becomes off the hook. I mean, do you realize how many people would love to put to pen and paper what you just said? Now, when we try to expand our mind, let's go back to the Bible. I have taught you, since I could teach you, about the tribulation trigger, correct?
Mm-hmm.
This is a magical moment. When he whose place is in the land, in the midst of the rivers, he crosses the threshold and enters into the beautiful land, that's the tribulation trigger. God comes off the hook. That's when he intervenes himself. That's the great day of he who sitteth upon the throne. That's the tribulation trigger. And it would seem that this trigger unleashes these four angels bound at the great river Euphrates. Now,
yeah, we came to the conclusion that okay, so we have seven heads of Satan. It says five have fallen, and that indicated. And I came to the conclusion through some hardcore study that Azazel is one of these. Azazel is one of the five who have fallen. So, and we know he was separated into a place called Dudael.
Yep.
A place in the abyss specifically called Dudael. And then he has, but then there's another four. And there were at least two of them who we have evidence in the book of Enoch that two of other Satans came with him. So there were three,
right,
who ruled the second incursion. And one of these was Azazel. But
now, wait a
Azazel
minute.
Was separated from the other two in this first incursion.
Okay. You misquoted yourself. You said the second. No, not the second. There were three in the first. That's the first incursion. Azazel, Samael, and Aramel. Mm-hmm. Okay? That was the first incursion. So you misquoted. You actually said that was the second incursion. For the second incursion, we came up with the simple fact this name is variously Nabu and Kazdi. That's the second incursion, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're not going to get the head, but here you have these four other angelic entities. Like you already stated, It's not Azazel. The scapegoat is in the abyss. So you're talking about the two that accompanied him on the first incursion, and then the next two, which was the second incursion, them obviously trying to keep this bloodline infused with the seed of the fallen.
Yes. The first incursion, these two angels that helped Azazel, they're referred to in Job as the helpers of Rahab. They were also chained for aiding him, but I don't know if they actually engaged in the same acts as Azazel himself and the other person would, but they were acting as helpers in the incursion and just like instigating it. And then,
well, more importantly, what you're trying to say, if they're not in the abyss, what you're saying is they were aiding and abetting the scapegoat.
Yeah, literally. And in crime, you know, if you're, even though if you didn't commit the crime, if you didn't commit a murder, if you let it happen in your house and you knew about it, you would get imprisoned as well.
Right.
Because you conspired with it.
Right.
So, in the second incursion, we have these angels. I think they initiated it in the act themselves. I'm not sure. Maybe they were getting other angels to do it for them. I don't know. But these two, we've given various names, and I can't even pinpoint what their true names are for sure. I mean, they're so corrupt in the Ethiopic Book of Enoch we have now. In the Ethiopic Book of Enoch, they appear as Peneme and Kazdi. And I'm not sure how corrupt those names are, if we can even get to the original. But these two were engaging in that act. So we have two from the first incursion and two from the second incursion who are bound by the river Euphrates. And this is in Revelation chapter 9. We've revisited this so many times because every time that we tried to come to a conclusion, I was not satisfied. It did not feel like we had reached anything that was solid enough to say anything, because the Bible doesn't come out and refer to any time angels being bound in the river Euphrates. We suggested that possibly this is the War of the Nine Kings in the Valley of Siddim.
It's got to be, son. But it has to be.
But there in the Valley of Siddim, which is where the Dead Sea is now, the Euphrates isn't even near there. So we have... So why is it the river Euphrates? So
that
finally,
is his border.
So finally, I just stepped back and was like, what if they're not literally bound in the river Euphrates, but by it? What if they're released by the action of the tribulation trigger?
When he crosses that river,
and who is
trigger.
He? And who is he?
He is the Assyrian false prophet.
Yeah, and more commonly known as the Antichrist. He is their Maaz. And it says that once he crosses that river, he comes with those angels to start taking down the holy places.
Right.
So this is in detail in Psalms chapter 74. So these two second incursions are referred to in Isaiah as Rahab who remains.
Rahab who remains, yes.
So part of the first incursion that was allowed to continue for the second incursion.
So just to be clear, when we go back to Revelation, now we realize that everything makes sense. Okay, let's go through this one more time. How many kings does Revelation say there are?
Seven.
And what does it say about the first five?
The first five have fallen.
Okay. To be clear, we've explained who they are. That's the scapegoat, Azazel. His two cohorts for that event, we state, is Aramel and Samael, correct?
Yeah.
That's three. The other two's the second incursion that did this down in the Valley of Siddim, which God nuked and is presently under the tar pits. It's presently under the Dead Sea. And it's their angelic bodies. This is why God nuked it with fire and brimstone. He was doing something to alter their physical form. This is why one of the greatest mineral deposits in the world is, guess what? The Dead Sea. Okay. So there you have these five. So the two for the second incursion, the closest that we can come is Naboo and Kasdi. Then the Bible says what one is. We've pinpointed that to be who?
Abaddon.
The one that is coming that he makes a pact with. One has a cloven. One has the male seed to bring together and make this covenant. Who's he?
Belial.
So now it all makes sense. And we see impregnated into the text. Let's get back to the red-headed infusion. I've already read to you the technical data that was released in this documentary about the Ireland Atlantis. Their red-headed DNA is found everywhere. I already presented the evidence with which David Rowe showed the world. That statue with the coat of many colors has red hair. I mean, this is literally starting to make sense. You take these mythologies and put them to the biblical text, and it begins to make positive sense to the narrative.
So, so in various texts we see, especially in the Sandinikon, which is mentioned in Eusebius's text, that one of these fallen angels, probably Naboo, also called Thoth, he fled to Egypt, where he was messing around with what he wanted, but God said he would punish the gods of Egypt, and he did so during the time of Moses.
Yes.
This other one, called Dagon, I don't know whenever he got defeated, but it makes me wonder if it was during the time of Jesus Christ. We suggested that perhaps, mentioned before that perhaps Herod the Great wanted his grandson, Herod Agrippa, to be the Messiah.
Yeah.
Because he was born 11 BC, right after Jesus was born. Same star, same everything.
Yeah, same star, same everything.
And we find it, okay, Aristobulus was a son whom, was his own son whom he murdered for sedition, and one named
Bernice, taking you straight back to the Daniel narrative. She is the one mentioned there, isochronally speaking.
Yeah, and it's very clear in the Bible that Herod's line was cursed. Herod the Great died in a way nobody even knows what killed him. They called it the evil of Herod. He dies. Then we have eventually Herod Archelaus. He is banished from the throne and dies in exile. Then his brother Antipas goes in there. I forget what happens to him. But he doesn't make it to the time of the Acts. Then his grandson Agrippa makes it to the throne. What happens to him? He's eaten by worms. So clearly this line is cursed. Why? Was Herod himself... Okay, this is the crazy part of who Herod was. He was an Arab. Or more specifically, he was an Edomite. Given authority over Jerusalem? He said that he converted to Judaism, but he wasn't even a Jew. He gained enough power under Caesar himself that he was able to call himself king. How is he allowed to call himself king without being taken down by the Romans? I think, was he working with this fallen angel, this other angel, by which his seed was cursed? Was he trying to make the false Messiah at that time? Was he trying to do that? And by that reason, that was why he was against Jesus and his apostles. Why Jesus was ever crucified was because this strife was going on. But was this second angel, was he bound? What was this fourth and final entity? Was he bound when Jesus descended?
Interesting proposition you have going on there. But now we give some meat to this Magog. It's absolutely amazing. You line up these mythologies and then you just look at it. And it's just off the hook that even the Native Americans, I mean, these Indians are just saying, look, the red-headed giants, we're having to duke it out with them. It just keeps going back to the biblical script. It's like history is playing off the biblical narrative. And it's kind of scary when you get in and look at it. Get your hands dirty. Start looking into these mythologies. And it's just absolutely amazing when you bring up that, you know, the bloodlines that you were talking about there with Perseus. Absolutely off the hook that right there you see that there's this continual injection of this fallen seed. It's just off the hook. You just take a look at it, Aaron, and it's just off the hook.
Yeah. Like I said, you have Zeus appears in here four times and Poseidon once. So clearly this Zeus was focused on this bloodline for whatever reason it was. But this was, like we said, they would die out by the fourth generation. By the fourth generation, you would have a Nephilite child that wouldn't have any angel within them.
He would, all of his angelic DNA would be recessive. That would all be recessive, and he would appear, by all rights, he would be a normal human being.
Yeah, so in order for them to stop this from happening, they would have to take a female within the line and have that same angel, you know, to mate with her and continue the line. But this is probably the purpose of blood pacts and why they were ever a thing, was that the angel would make a pact that he would be
he would literally be their
loyal. He would be loyal to their bloodline.
Right. He would every fourth generation show up and replenish his seed in their line.
Yeah, and he would, whatever deal he made, for him to do that, he would have children, and you would have power.
And he, more importantly, they would get their, this Muaz. They would just keep kicking the can down the road, biding their time. But eventually, we get to this event horizon where they come up with this cloven. And you and I need to really talk about what the text actually says. You know, Aaron, it's pretty plain that we've talked about that this project probably had a name. And I've referred to you privately anyway, the simple fact that it appears that this project was probably taken off world. And that you are plainly told in the biblical narrative that this project is going to be brought back to the late great planet Earth. You're told all the details.
So are they taken to another planet? Are they taken to another dimension? What's going on?
We don't know. We need to consult that text. We probably need to address this topic for sure. We need to bring in the simple fact that what's the in vitro capital of the world? We have right now mainstream news unleashing upon an unsuspecting world. They're already editing embryos, Aaron. This facility is going to be built, and we know exactly where those two cloven are going to bring it.
I'm beginning to start wondering why the Nazi movement was so focused on the Aryans. I've been doing a lot of reading about who the Aryans were, and the Aryans were a Japhethite bloodline. Some of them went to India, some of them stayed in Persia, and someone went to the north and went into Europe. But we have Persians who claim, we actually have evidence, that they could have been descendants of the tribe of Ephraim. So these Aryans having the bloodline of Ephraim would be, of course, where they would have to go to get their queen,
okay,
the daughter of women.
You need to qualify that statement. Why would they have to go to Ephraim?
Because the scripture says that God says that Ephraim is my Maos.
I think that statement probably took the listener by complete surprise. So, this being the case, let us consider that here very soon we may need to unleash upon the world this as our next episode. The biblical narrative tells us that these two cloven are protecting this project that's going on.
They're taking it to the land of Shinar. Which is, where is Shinar?
Let's just let that stew. Okay, we will unleash this upon an unsuspecting world in our next show. We've been building up to it. We have everything in place. Look, this tale of the Irish Atlantis, look, I want to remind you once again, the Book of Enoch plainly states, the Bible plainly states, that the flood was not designed to take out the giants. It was designed to take out the wickedness of man. Correct?
Correct.
You will take note. What this Irish story states, this red-headed narrative, is that these women were banished for what? Extreme wickedness. They were banished to a place, and the angels seized advantage of the opportunity and took them to be their wives. This is where the story, this is the riddle of Alba. So, with this in mind, our next show is going to come to grips with this Project Muaz. This thing is in operation right now. You know that the biblical prophet, whom I will not name, he gives you fantastic intimate details that they took it somewhere. Now, what I would say would be, you got a couple of options. It's on the dark side of the moon, or it's on Europa. But with that in mind, we're going to cross the Rubicon the very next time, because it's already been released into the public that they are actively editing the genome. They're actively doing it. So you have to take note that this, Aaron, this very family tree that you directed everybody to of this Egyptus, right there appears the name Europa.
Yeah, as a daughter of this Angus, or Angor.
So with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, until next time, God bless, Godspeed.
FringeRadioNetwork.com/donate. We don't need your money to survive. We pay for the network with our own hard-earned cash. But if you want to help us grow and reach more people, just go to FringeRadioNetwork.com/donate. For a donation of $20 or more, we'll send you a free network t-shirt. FringeRadioNetwork.com/donate.